The room is quiet in the way only trusted spaces are quiet. No flyers, no contracts on the table, just faces that already know one another. A man stands near the front, not elevated, not rushed. He does not introduce himself. He does not need to. Everyone knows who he is. He helped people find jobs. He translated paperwork. He spoke up when landlords would not listen. Now he is offering something else, an opportunity meant only for people like them. The returns sound steady, not flashy. The risk sounds low. The explanation is simple. He says banks do not understand their community. He says regulators move slow. He says this is how people like them get ahead. Heads nod, checks are written, cash changes hands, trust does the rest. Months later, money will stop moving. Questions will surface behind closed doors. Regulators will begin pulling records that never should have been trusted to silence. By the time the truth is public, the damage will already be done. This was not a random scam. It was targeted. It was patient. And it was built on something far more valuable than money. Chapter 1. The offer you do not question. The gathering takes place after hours, once the regular business of the day has ended. The doors are closed. Phones are lowered. The people inside are familiar with one another through shared language, shared struggle, and shared history. Some arrived in the country decades earlier. Others came recently. All understand what it means to rely on one another when formal systems feel distant or hostile. The man speaking does not stand behind a podium. He leans against a table, relaxed. His authority does not come from titles. It comes from presence. For years, he has been the one people turn to when paperwork is confusing or rules seem designed to exclude them. He knows which offices respond faster. He knows who to call. He knows how things really work. He begins by reminding the room where they come from, the barriers they faced, the way banks turned them away when they first tried to open accounts, the loans that never came through, the fees that ate into what little they had. He frames the opportunity as a solution born from experience, not greed. This is not about getting rich. This is about keeping money within the community. The investment is described as private, not secret, but selective. Only people who understand the culture, only people who can be trusted not to draw attention. He explains that outside scrutiny complicates things. Regulators ask questions that slow progress. Paperwork creates delays. This system avoids all of that. It moves faster. It works quietly. There are no printed prospectuses, no formal explanations of strategy. Instead, there are stories. A cousin who doubled his savings in a year, a friend who paid off debt sooner than expected, a small business owner who finally had breathing room. Each example is offered casually, as if the success is ordinary. Early participants confirm the results. They talk about monthly returns that arrive on time. They mention how easy it was to get started. Some describe the relief of seeing money grow without having to navigate institutions that never seemed built for them. Their confidence carries more weight than any spreadsheet. Money is collected in different ways. Some write checks, some transfer funds through personal accounts, others bring cash. Receipts are informal, records are minimal. Everything is framed as temporary until the next phase begins, when the structure will be more formal, more official. That moment never arrives. The man emphasizes discretion. He warns against discussing the opportunity with outsiders. Not because there is anything wrong, he says, but because misunderstanding breeds problems. He reminds them how quickly authorities can interfere when they do not understand cultural context. He positions silence as protection, not concealment. Oversight is barely mentioned. When someone asks about regulation, the answer is vague but confident. The investments are described as private arrangements. Exemptions are referenced without specifics. The reassurance rests on his tone, not on documentation. As weeks pass, the group grows. Invitations extend outward through family ties and social networks. Each new participant arrives with built-in trust, reassured by the people who brought them in. The circle widens, but the structure remains opaque. Payments arrive as promised. The consistency quiets doubts. Success stories circulate more than questions. Anyone who hesitates is reminded of missed chances in the past. The fear of being left behind pushes people forward. From the outside, there is little to see. No advertising, no public claims, no obvious red flags. Transactions blend into everyday financial noise. The amounts increase steadily, but not dramatically enough to attract immediate attention. Inside the community, the investment becomes part of conversation, not openly celebrated, but quietly acknowledged, a shared secret that feels empowering. Participation becomes a marker of belonging. What no one in the room can see is the imbalance forming beneath the surface. The growth outpaces any legitimate explanation. New money begins to support old promises. The system depends entirely on confidence. At this stage, nothing has collapsed. No one has lost money yet. The danger lies not in what has happened, but in how unquestioned it all feels. Trust has replaced verification. Loyalty has replaced oversight. The pool of money continues to expand. It grows faster than the explanations offered for how it works. Chapter 2: Paper Trails and Quiet Doubts. The first problem does not arrive as a collapse. It arrives as a delay. A payment that usually lands on the same day of the month comes 2 days late, then three. The investor who notices it does not speak up in the group chat. He calls privately. The explanation is calm: a banking issue, a processing delay, nothing to worry about. The money arrives the following week. Relief settles in. The moment passes. But delays have a way of multiplying. Another investor experiences the same thing the next month, then another. Each time, the issue is handled quietly. Questions stay off public channels. People are encouraged to be patient. They are reminded that the system works best when it is not stressed by panic. Inside the community, silence is framed as responsibility. Raising concerns publicly, some are told, could draw the wrong kind of attention. Outsiders would not understand. Regulators would overreact. The group has come too far to risk interference now. The language shifts subtly. What began as reassurance becomes pressure. Loyalty is implied. Doubt is treated as weakness. Anyone who asks too many questions is reminded of how much the organizer has already done for others. Gratitude becomes leverage. At the same time, money keeps flowing in. New participants continue to arrive, brought by relatives and trusted friends. They hear the success stories first, not the delays. The structure of trust insulates the core from scrutiny. Information travels unevenly, carefully filtered by relationships. Outside the community, a different process is unfolding. At a regional bank, a compliance officer flags a pattern. Multiple accounts tied to the same individual are moving unusually consistent sums. Incoming funds are steady. Outgoing payments follow a regular schedule. The activity does not match the stated income of the account holder. It does not match any registered business either. The officer files a routine report. No accusations, just anomalies. Another institution notices something similar weeks later. Transfers moving between personal accounts with no clear business purpose. Funds cycling rather than settling. Returns that appear fixed regardless of market conditions. Individually, none of it proves fraud. Together, it raises questions. Regulators begin looking quietly. They do not announce an investigation. They do not knock on doors. They request records. They compare timelines. They trace flows. What they see does not align with the explanations given to investors. There is no evidence of underlying assets producing returns. No verified investments generating profit. The money coming in appears to be the same money going out, redistributed to maintain confidence. The pattern fits a familiar structure. Inside the community, unease grows. A small business owner who invested heavily begins to worry about cash flow. He requests a partial withdrawal. The response is slower than before. He is told large withdrawals require notice. He is reminded of the long-term benefits of staying in. He agrees to wait. Another investor notices that communication has become more controlled. Updates that once came freely are now brief. Meetings are postponed. Explanations are shorter. Still, no one wants to be the first to say it out loud. Speaking up feels dangerous in a different way, not financially, but socially. Accusing a respected insider feels like accusing the community itself. For immigrants who have learned to rely on internal support systems, the idea of inviting outside scrutiny feels like betrayal. Some begin keeping records privately, screenshots of transfers, notes about dates. They do not share them yet. They are preparing without admitting why. The organizer responds to growing tension by tightening the narrative. He acknowledges delays but reframes them as proof of growth. Too much money moving too fast, he says. Systems catching up. He promises structural changes soon. new accounts, new protections. No documents are provided. Behind the scenes, regulators escalate. They issue formal requests for information. They subpoena bank records. They map relationships between accounts. The scale becomes clear. Millions of dollars have moved through the network. The majority originates from individuals within the same immigrant community. The targeting is not accidental. The trust is specific, deliberate. Investigators interview financial professionals familiar with affinity fraud. The description matches closely. Insiders leveraging cultural bonds, appeals to shared identity, discouragement of outside verification, emphasis on discretion. The investigation remains sealed. Inside the community, cracks form. A whistleblower considers speaking to authorities. She worries about retaliation, not violent, but social. Isolation, accusations of disloyalty. She has family ties to people still invested. Any move she makes will ripple. She meets with an attorney quietly. The attorney explains the risks, explains what cooperation looks like, explains that timing matters. Withdrawals begin increasing, not en masse, but steadily. The system strains, payments slow further, explanations repeat. The organizer becomes harder to reach. Messages go unanswered longer. Meetings are rescheduled more often. When he does appear, his tone is defensive rather than confident. The pressure builds on both sides. Regulators finalize their case. They prepare coordinated action to prevent further losses. Freezing accounts becomes an option. Timing becomes critical. Move too soon and evidence disappears. Move too late and more money is lost. Within the community, rumors surface. Someone heard something from a cousin. Someone else noticed police vehicles near a bank branch. Nothing is confirmed. Anxiety spreads. Trust begins to fracture along quiet lines. Those who invested early and made money feel defensive. Those who invested later and are waiting feel exposed. Conversations become careful. Words are chosen cautiously. The organizer sends out a message calling for calm. He frames the moment as a test, faith versus fear. He urges everyone to stand together. At the same time, withdrawals spike sharply. The math no longer works. Regulators schedule the enforcement action. Warrants are prepared. Press statements are drafted but not yet released. Investigators coordinate across agencies. The moment approaches when silence will no longer be possible. As the final withdrawals process, alarms trigger inside financial systems. Accounts lock. Transfers halt midstream. Phones ring unanswered. The structure that relied entirely on confidence begins to seize. And for the first time, the community feels something shift. Not panic yet, but the unmistakable sense that the story they were told can no longer hold. The quiet phase is ending. Chapter 3, when trust becomes evidence. The announcement does not come through the community first. It comes through a public notice issued by regulators on a weekday morning. Written in plain language and backed by numbers that leave little room for interpretation. Accounts have been frozen, and enforcement action has been filed. The operation is identified for what it is, a Ponzi scheme that relied on new investor funds to pay earlier participants. Losses are measured in the millions. By the time most phones light up across the community, messages collide. Some people read the notice in disbelief, scanning for mistakes, for misunderstandings, for anything that might suggest this is temporary. Others feel a sudden, heavy clarity. The delays, the pressure to stay quiet, the missing paperwork, it all clicks into place at once. Regulators move quickly to secure records, bank statements, wire histories, internal communications. What had once been shielded by discretion becomes data. Investigators trace the flow of money with precision, mapping how funds entered, moved, and exited the network. The pattern is consistent. New contributions supported existing obligations. There was no independent source of revenue. The structure had always been hollow. The organizer is detained and questioned. His public confidence disappears under scrutiny. Statements that once sounded reassuring are now compared against documentation. Claims of legitimate investment activity cannot be substantiated. Explanations shift. Timelines blur. Investigators separate what can be proven from what was merely promised. Inside the community, the reaction fractures along lines of experience and timing. Those who entered early and withdrew more than they invested struggle with guilt. Some insist they had no idea. Others argue they were victims too, manipulated by the same trust. Those who invested late, who never saw returns, feel anger sharpen into betrayal. Savings meant for homes, education, or retirement are gone or frozen indefinitely. Meetings are called, not to plan investments, but to process shock. People argue over responsibility. Some blame regulators for acting too late. Others blame themselves for not questioning earlier. A few still defend the organizer, insisting the system could have recovered if not interrupted. The evidence does little to change their belief. Trust, once given, does not withdraw easily. Regulators hold press briefings. They explain the mechanics of the fraud carefully. No sensational language. No accusations beyond what records support. They outline how affinity fraud works, how shared identity becomes a shield, how cultural trust is exploited to bypass skepticism. They emphasize that the targeting was deliberate. The losses are calculated conservatively. Only confirmed investments are counted. The total is still staggering. Millions of dollars taken almost entirely from members of a single immigrant network. The concentration is undeniable. Civil actions begin. Victims file claims seeking recovery. The process is slow and uncertain. Some assets are seized, others are already gone. Money that moved through multiple accounts is difficult to trace completely. Recovery will be partial at best. Criminal charges follow based on documented violations. Prosecutors outline the case methodically. Misrepresentation, fraud, money laundering where applicable, each charge tied to specific evidence, each allegation supported by records. There is no dramatic courtroom scene, just procedure. Sentencing comes later. The penalties reflect both the scale of the losses and the method of deception. The court acknowledges the harm extended beyond finances. The damage to trust, to community cohesion, is noted explicitly. But punishment does not restore what was taken. In the months that follow, the community changes in subtle but lasting ways. Informal financial help becomes rare. Requests for assistance are met with hesitation. Where trust once moved freely, now verification is demanded. People who once relied on shared language and history now ask for contracts, licenses, and proof. Community leaders step forward to address the rupture. Workshops are organized, financial literacy sessions, warnings about affinity fraud. Speakers explain how to verify investments, how to check registrations, how to recognize red flags. The tone is careful. No one wants to appear accusatory, but the caution is unmistakable. Some relationships never recover. Families argue over who introduced whom. Friendships end quietly. Shame lingers, especially among those who encouraged others to invest. Even when intentions were good, the outcome feels unforgivable. Regulators reflect internally on the case. They review how long the scheme operated before detection. They examine reporting thresholds. They consider whether earlier intervention could have reduced losses. Policy discussions follow. Adjustments are proposed, but systems move slowly. Affinity fraud remains difficult to catch precisely because it hides inside trust. The case becomes a reference point in future investigations. Training materials include anonymized examples from it. The pattern is taught, the warning signs emphasized. Still, enforcement agencies acknowledge the limits of oversight when communities self-police and discourage outside scrutiny. For the victims, closure is incomplete. Some recover a portion of their funds, others recover nothing. Many rebuild slowly, starting from less than they had before. The financial setback compounds existing vulnerabilities. Dreams are delayed or abandoned. What lingers longest is not the loss of money, but the loss of certainty. The idea that someone from inside the community would protect others had once felt unshakable. Now it feels conditional. Trust must be earned differently, verified, not assumed. The story circulates beyond the community as well. Media coverage highlights the mechanics of the fraud without naming individuals beyond official records. The focus stays on the method, on how easily shared identity can be turned into a weapon. Regulators issue public advisories. They warn that affinity fraud often appears where trust is strongest, that exclusivity is not protection, that secrecy is not safety. Years later, the case is no longer front page news, but its impact persists in quiet decisions. In hesitation before signing anything informal, in the pause before recommending an opportunity to a friend. The scheme ends on paper the day enforcement action is announced. In reality, it ends slowly as people recalibrate how they relate to one another. The fraud is over. The money trail is closed. The legal outcomes are final. What remains is a community learning how to rebuild trust without surrendering it blindly again.